Welcome to the Visegrad Insight podcast from Central Europe on Central Europe.
Hello and welcome to the Visegrad Insight podcast. My name is Stash Kaleta and I am joined by Adam Yasser, our deputy managing editor.
Hello, Stash.
Today is Monday, the 18th of March, and we will be discussing the meeting of the leaders of France, Germany and Poland in Berlin last Friday. We will also talk about Viktor Orban's latest manoeuvres, including his trip to visit Donald Trump and his speech at a rally in Budapest for Hungary's National Day, also last Friday. At a symbolic level, the meeting of Emmanuel Macron, Olaf Scholz and Donald Tusk was very important. It was a sort of resurrection of the Weimar Triangle, and the leaders of France, Germany and Poland reaffirmed their commitment to arm Ukraine. But there has been much tension in recent weeks, especially between Macron and Scholz. Could you expand on that context a little bit?
Right. Yes. The President Macron has a tendency to surprise his European partners with statements and often analysis. Some French commentators meanly suggest that he's France's think tanker in chief, because he sometimes just speaks his mind, which you know, we all know politicians have to be very careful with what they say because words have a meaning. So in Macron's case, you know, when he says we cannot be so predictable for Putin, we cannot constrain ourselves by drawing red lines and indicating when these red lines are for us. And this is, of course, an implied criticism of Germany and Chancellor Scholz. But given that such statements by Macron are immediately countered by other leaders in Europe, creates a sense that there's this unity, and ironically or paradoxically, this shows Putin that there is no real unity. So the meeting on Friday aimed at trying to raise above the flow of statements and put some unity on display. The added significance of this is, of course, that this marks Poland's return to the main European game. As we know, for 8 years, Poland was reluctant to engage with Germany in particular, but also with France. And for many reasons, Euroscepticism, phobia about Germany from the previously ruling Law and Justice Party, Poland was playing its own game, basically, in Europe. So now Poland is returning to the fold, and there is a widespread expectation in European capitals that Prime Minister Tusk, with his experience of being head of the EU Council, can somehow smoothen or oil the machinery between France and Germany. Some of these expectations clearly are getting ahead of themselves. You know, it's not just there's no magic formula in which Poland can suddenly become a power broker in Europe. But certainly trying to get these three countries on the same wavelength is important, and it was on display on Friday, where the three leaders clearly showed that they can reach a basic understanding of what needs to be done. So, you know, Poland is back in the game. Macron has he's making a bid to be the leader of Europe, and Chancellor Scholz is primarily concerned with his domestic political standing. As we know, SPD, his party, is trailing in opinion polls. There is a tricky string of elections, local and national eventually. And the far-right party, which is strong in Eastern Germany and pro-Russian, you know, is close to a breakthrough in some of the states. So his domestic considerations are obviously very prominent. So the bottom line is, you know, it's good that these leaders met. It's good that Poland is back at the table, given its size, role on the eastern flank of NATO, neighborhood with Ukraine. But at the end of the day, there's still no, let's say, fundamental agreement on, for example, increasing Western and NATO presence in Ukraine as a, I don't know, boots on the ground or even instructors or things like that, or for that matter, long-range missiles, the by now famous Taurus missiles.
Okay, so you said that Poland kind of has entered the game again, and a lot of people said that Tusk was a sort of mediator, could serve as a sort of mediator. How effective do you think he was at that? How effective do you think the meeting was? You said that there weren't really any steps made or confirmed, but could you expand on that a little bit more?
Well, the trouble is I cannot, because we haven't seen anything more specific than that. Tusk is extremely pragmatic on these issues, so I think he realizes that Scholz has his limitations and that he can be pushed only so much. So I think he probably focused on his message that the three countries need to be speaking similar language, and this is what really Europe needs. If anything, I would only suggest that probably Italy is missing from that configuration because of its size, because its significance in the European defense industry, and because Giorgia Meloni, who comes from a far-right party, no doubt about it, but who at the same time is taking a rather hawkish view on Russia's aggression on Ukraine. And she's also, surprisingly, for many Eurosceptics in Europe, she is staunchly pro-European. So she's clever enough to realize that none of the countries in Europe, including the big countries, can act independently in a world dominated by the US-China rivalry, by the rise of Asian powers, and that therefore European unity is paramount if European countries want to preserve their way of life, their traditions, their democratic systems. So, you know, to me, Meloni is the missing person in this configuration.
Okay. And you talked just there about European unity. One thorn in that unity is very much Hungary and Viktor Orban. How does this sort of meeting compare to him and what he's been doing recently? So after Orban's visit to Mar-a-Lago and his endorsement of Donald Trump, US Ambassador to Hungary David Pressman criticized the country's dangerously unhinged anti-American messaging and its expanding relationship with Russia. Could you expand on that?
Well, I think we saw in February at the EU summit that Viktor Orban is completely isolated in Europe. And also, it's harder and harder for him to play his usual blackmailing game, you know. Even if the Commission released some money for Hungary, and let's remember that money for Hungary is suspended at the moment, most of it. So even if the Commission, when the Commission decided to release some of that money, it is now being challenged and sued by European Parliament. So for many governments and for many lawmakers in European capitals, but also in Brussels or in Strasbourg, Orban has already crossed too many red lines, and his continued behavior as a sort of Putin's mouthpiece in Europe means that his influence is really reduced. And, you know, Hungary's economy is not doing greatly either. There are growing concerns about institutional changes that constrain the central bank or even the finance ministry. And of course, there was this huge sex scandal that has driven a wedge inside the Fidesz party, that sort of showed some cracks with several Fidesz faithful now threatening to break out. You know, we have this prominent Fidesz-linked person who actually managed to attract more crowds in Budapest than Orban himself. So, you know, Orban is looking more and more desperate, and his pronouncements are wilder and wilder. His visit in Mar-a-Lago certainly didn't help. And you know, any gains from that, even if his bet is correct, which I doubt, that Trump is poised for the return to the White House. Well, even that is not going to change much for Hungary. You know, for Trump, Hungary is just useful for domestic purposes to show him around in messaging to sort of alt-right supporters. But Hungary is too small a player for Trump to seriously engage with Hungary in any meaningful way. European investment is down, and Orban is increasingly counting on China filling in the gap in investment. You know, this is a risky strategy given that Europe is also concerned about Chinese investment. So all in all, you know, Orban has lost some of his magic, if you will, and he's increasingly isolated. And of course, you know, the fact that Poland is no longer supporting Orban in EU struggles is significant in this context. So yes, there is a lot of noise. There are these wild proclamations that he's going to march on Brussels and occupy it, presumably with some other far right parties. But what I would like to stress, and it's a point I made, you know, several months ago in one of the texts I wrote about the resilience of the mainstream, which is not so much about even the attractiveness of the mainstream European parties from the right and from the center and from the left, but it's also the incoherence of the far right and the radical vote, because between them, they are different. They very often cannot agree on a common platform. So, you know, some of the scares that we often hear about the resurgent far right in Europe and how they are going to make a huge impact in the European elections in June, it's true. They will probably overall increase their number of seats in the European Parliament. But whether that translates into their ability to actually get into the institutional game, which at the end of the day is where the decisions are, that's a different story. And there are divisions, and the ostracism that some of them face. You know, the best example is what happened to Mr. Wilders in the Dutch, you know, after the Dutch election. He's been trying to put together a government, but at the end of the day, he failed because nobody really wants to work with him. And if you look at the dynamics between Meloni, Orban, and some other far-right parties, the AfD, you know, it's extremely hard for them to find a common ticket. There is a lot of talk and speculation that there will be a lot of reshuffling within those far right groupings. And I would like to remind everyone, if they don't know it already, is that there are already two groupings in the European Parliament: the European Conservatives and Reformers, which are the sort of more mainstream Eurosceptics, if you will. Pardon if that description is oversimplified. And then you have the far right, pro-Russian and sort of really disruptive forces in the grouping AfD and some of the really scary characters. And these two groups, they simply won't be able to cooperate. So one of the possible scenarios is, of course, for the mainstream right-wingers, so the EPP, the conservatives, which includes the CDU, which includes Mr. Tusk's coalition here, and as well as the peasants in Poland and some other mainstream conservative parties across Europe, that they will switch or enter some kind of an alliance with Meloni's conservatives in the ECR party. Interestingly, Law and Justice, the opposition party in Poland, is part of that grouping. So this can also create an interesting dynamic. But if that fails, for a number of reasons, there is still the possibility of so-called grand coalition of mainstream parties in the next European Parliament. So the Conservatives, the Socialists, the Greens, the Liberals, and they will maintain their majority. So yes, there may be a swing to the right. There may be a bit more attempts at disruption, but ultimately the disruptors themselves are disrupted internally, so to speak.
Okay, so the EP elections are obviously still a couple months away. This weekend that just went, we had the Russian elections or sham elections. What can you say about that, and how does that tie into what you've just been saying?
Right, you know, you're right. It wasn't really an election. It was a staged, managed election with intimidation of voters, and of course no real rivals, particularly after Mr. Navalny was murdered in prison, and another candidate who openly spoke against the Russia's aggression in Ukraine was excluded several weeks back. So, you know, so the fact that Mr. Putin claimed a landslide, it's just nonsense. And of course, most European Western governments made clear that they don't consider this to be a fair and normal election. So it's just a pretense of democracy. But I think it's important to stress that, you know, many Russians managed to manifest their opposition to Putin's policies, even though this is a risky thing. And we sometimes in the West, in Poland and in other countries where the outrage over Russia's activities in Ukraine and elsewhere is high, people say all Russians are the same, and, you know, every one of them would do the same thing as Putin. They're equally bad. Well, you know, the price of rebelling against Putin is very high. You know, people like Navalny and others have paid with their lives at the risk prison and intimidation and persecution. So, you know, for so many thousands of Russians to actually display their opposition by showing up at the polling stations at noon, which was what Navalny had called on them to do, that's to me significant. As is the fact that all the Russians that escaped from Russia in the past 2 years, partly to avoid the draft, let's be open about it, but also partly because they feel less and less comfortable with the path that Putin is plotting for Russia. You know, many of them voted, used this as opportunity to vote abroad and as a protest against Putin. So the discontent is there. You know, the control by the government is huge over society. So sometimes we just don't see it. And very often the Russian propaganda seems to portray Russians as a united bloc in the aggression against Ukraine, but certainly isn't that easy. So that's an encouraging sign. But unfortunately, on the flip side of this mock election, this false election has certainly allowed Mr. Putin to consolidate and cement his power over Russia and his dictatorship effectively. So, and given his view of the Ukraine war and his confrontational approach to the West in general, this spells nothing but trouble.
Okay, Adam. Well, thank you for summarizing those points about the Weimar Triangle, about Viktor Orban and the Russian elections, and we'll be back next week.
Thank you so much.